Welcome back to Work Actually, the podcast that delves into the reality behind different jobs and careers. I'm Kate, the host of the podcast, and this is the first episode of Series 3. I've realised I've not really given away too much about who I am, so now that the podcast has been going for quite a while and I've had some fantastic guests, it might be nice to give a little bit of info about who I am and why I started the podcast. So I've always been really intrigued about the day-to-day lives of people in different jobs, and in the times where I've looked around at different career paths, I would get so frustrated about the lack of information on what the job was truly like. Because you can read job descriptions on recruitment sites and you can read employee reviews, often from people who have left a company, and you get glossy day in the life pieces in the media, which are designed to really just show the best parts and be entertaining. So I could tell there was this gap really of what was going on under the skin of different career paths, and for nosy people like me and for those looking to change career to be able to learn more about whether it's the right route for them. Now, today's episode is such a great example of the kind of career I love to learn about. It's something slightly out of the ordinary in that you might not know it exists, but it's intriguing and unusual and someone that is accessible to everyone. So I spoke to Adrian Simpson, and I think I can confidently call him the UK's leading wedding speechwriter. His job is to write best man, groomsman, father of the bride, bridesmaid, basically speeches for all those people putting themselves under so much pressure to deliver something that works on all levels. So something that's funny and personal, endearing and not too long or not too short. It's good for mates and it works for the 89-year-old grandparents. So he literally encounters people from all walks of life, including really successful and famous people, all of which still worry about public speaking and making sure they do a good job. My chat with Adrian was great, not just because his job is so interesting, but because he has such an interesting career path, and it's a great example of someone who saw an opportunity to set up his own business. If you know anyone getting married or worried about making something like a best man speech, give them this pod to listen to, because it will certainly make them realise they are not alone in feeling scared and there is help out there. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. Adrian, thank you so much for joining Work Actually tonight. It's great to have you on.
No, thank you for asking me.
When I started Work Actually, the idea was to shed light on more unusual jobs, the ones that you might not have heard of or don't quite know how they work. And that's exactly why I wanted you on the podcast, because I knew your company before, your company All Speeches Great and Small, which is a professional speech writing service. And of course, when you think of a speechwriter, maybe this is me, I think of maybe a politician with a speechwriter or a CEO that's doing a big speech. You don't think about, actually, there could be people that are hiring someone like you who are actually kind of everyday people, like a father of the bride or a best man or a groom or maybe even a bridesmaid needing help in putting that speech together. And that's what you do.
Focus on wedding speeches. So there are a few firms that cover wedding speeches. Some around the world may specialize in best man speeches, but I'm the only one that just does all wedding speeches. And yeah, you're right. When people think about a speechwriter, they do think about, you know, politicians and maybe more corporate kind of events. But pretty much the only speech that most people will ever make in their life is a wedding speech. And most people, you know, give up creative writing when they're about 16. Most people's lives don't revolve around being entertaining or being, I mean, God forbid, being funny. So when it comes to them, you know, say classically in their mid-30s, and they've got to make an entertaining, funny speech, then it's so far out of their skill set that you know, they need some help, and a lot of these guys haven't got time to invest in it. So that's where it comes in. And nobody was more surprised than me to become a speechwriter. I didn't set out. It's been a like funny old journey, but yeah.
Why is there so much emphasis on best man speeches? There's such a pressure, isn't there? I mean, I've been a bridesmaid a lot, and I had to do a speech once as a maid of honor, actually, in a wedding in America, and I remember feeling, God, the pressure of it, and
and the nerves, and yeah, you've got to be funny and you've got to be sweet and you've got to have those personal anecdotes, but you've got to, for me, I always had to think, right, I've got to do this to an American audience as well, which is, you know, slightly different humor. But the amount of weddings I've been to, the best man, the pressure that, you know, they're under, and you can see them, they're more nervous than the groom.
Oh, they're way more nervous than the groom. There's a huge amount of pressure on best men, particularly in the UK. It's a kind of a different gig in the States, and I write well over 50% of my speeches each year are for clients in the US. That's a different kind of speech. But there's a couple of reasons why people feel the pressure, and one is they've got to stand up and talk in front of a load of people, and you know there's a survey that was done a few years ago that says that 75% of us are more scared of the thought of public speaking than they are of the thought of death. Nobody likes that. And interestingly, in a digital world where, you know, the generation that are coming through, they don't do any communication verbally, or they avoid verbal communication because they do everything through text-based. So it's becoming more and more of a departure of what they're comfortable with and what they're used to. So that's only going to get probably worse for them. And also the big thing about a British best man speech and the Aussie best man speeches as well is that you have got to be funny. Everyone is expecting you to be the entertainment. Everyone's expecting you to make them laugh.
You've got that
funny best man speech. And the pressure to be funny for loads of guys is absolutely immense. I mean, they might be able to say something funny to their friends in the pub, but having a sustained comedy routine for about 7.5 minutes is which makes everyone laugh, which doesn't alienate anyone, which doesn't upset anyone, is really difficult. I mean, if you're not used to it, and some people just plain and simple aren't funny, and they're happy to admit they're not funny. So this is pretty much their worst nightmare. In fact, a friend of mine said it would ruin his year if someone made him best man. That's how much
his year.
I deal with guys with no exaggeration who have counselling because they're making a speech. They don't tell anyone, but they tell me. But they don't tell anyone because it can be if you get it wrong, it can be fairly traumatic. I mean, there's a guy who was going to book a speech with us a couple of years ago, and I don't know why he did it. It was on the Friday, the speech was the next day. That's kind of 24 hours turnaround. It's no strange thing for us, but he decided not to go for it. He thought, right, I'll take my chances and I won't do it. And I don't know why he did this, but he came back on the Monday to Amy, who works for me, and said, I just thought I'd let you know that it was the worst experience of my life. I started making a speech. It started going really, really wrong. I started to panic. I stopped speaking. Oh, and then I ran out of the wedding halfway through the speech. And he hadn't been in touch with anyone. And he hadn't spoken. And that, unfortunately, and I felt really sorry for the guy because, you know, it's a tough situation if it starts to go wrong. And that's with him for the rest of his life. I'm not saying that he should have booked with me, but that's just how difficult and challenging people can find it. And if they start to panic, if it starts to unravel and you've suddenly got 80, 120, maybe in some cases 300 sets of eyes looking at you, then you feel that you feel very, very much under the cosh. So my advice is, even if you don't use me, be prepared.
Literally, oh my god, I'm just thinking about that poor guy. I mean that's quite traumatic, isn't it? I've been at weddings before where you think, god, that was either a boring speech or all right, you were talking to your mates, really, you weren't really talking to the whole room. But to have to run out, I mean, the poor guy, hopefully there's someone that's reached out to him. But the thing is, when you write a speech as well, is you can prepare and you could write that speech for them, but it's also about the delivery, isn't it? Because it could still probably fall flat if put in some comedy and they don't deliver it in the right way.
There is that. I mean, the delivery, of course, is really important. But if you just take it slowly and steadily and don't try and think you've turned into Jimmy Carr for the afternoon or whatever, then you'll be all right, because people are looking for a relatable performance. They're not looking for a polished performance. They're looking for a bloke making a speech for his brother or friend that, you know, it doesn't have to be seamless. So if you have a few hiccups here and there and everything, but if you read it slowly and steadily, then everyone will be able to hear what you're saying. Everyone will be able to, you know, the speech can breathe and stuff like that. So people will get the gags and everything else. And the speech should take care of itself. Where lots of people go wrong is that their delivery comes across as poor because they've written their own speech. And most people who write their own speeches write their speeches as essays, not as speeches, because their only reference point for creative writing was, you know, writing sort of English GCSE, A-level, whatever it is, essays or history essays, whatever it is. So they write them as essays, great big, huge paragraphs, chunks of text, no pauses, no appreciation of what words go together, of difficult combination of word repetition and everything like that. So when they read it out, the delivery sounds pretty poor because that's because they're reading out a monotonous jumble of thoughts and ideas, and there's no getting around that. I mean, but people send me speeches all the time, it's very rare that someone will send me a speech. I don't edit speeches anymore. I gave that up ages ago because it's just more hassle than it's worth. But it's very rare that someone would send me a speech and I'd say, oh, that's actually quite good. I think it's happened about twice in the last 8 years that someone would send me a speech.
Really?
Yeah, all the rest are just horrific because people aren't used to it. And what they do is they go to the internet, they plunder a few gags. They're the same gags that everyone's used all before. They have a few thoughts and ideas down. They've got the same old cliches at the end, and it's all a bit boring. And you know, they've just run out of time because what I've come to understand, and being a man myself, is that most grown men are most comfortable with leaving things to the last minute, and then they start to think about them. And if you give yourself 2 weeks to write a best man speech, and you've got a busy job, you've got, you know, family, girlfriend, football, whatever it is going on, you haven't got many free hours in the week. So if you leave yourself 2 weeks to write a speech, in reality, you've probably left yourself about 4 hours to write a speech and learn it. And then that's when, you know, things start to get a bit funky when you have to sort of dream up a speech and get to know it in 4 hours.
So talk through the process then of when someone comes to you and they say, right, I'm getting married, or, you know, I've been asked to be a best man in a year's time.
Yeah.
I need help with my speech. How early do they come to you? I mean, you said that you spoke to someone who has, you know, was worrying about it all year wouldn't want to do it because it would worry them. How early do they come to you because they're panicking? Or do you get, I guess you probably get both. You probably get an early request of, I need help with this, while they start to think about it. And then do you get really last minute, help me, I need,
Yeah, I mean, my record is...
So what's the process?
The process is they find me on Google. They look at what's on my site and they think, actually, I might just call this guy, you know, and he can, because I've got lots of stuff on my site that would help you write speech ideas and videos and all that kind of thing. But, you know, if you're thinking, do you know what, I might just, it's a once in a lifetime, I'll ring agents. So they call me, we have a chat. And if they, you know, like the sound of what I'm about, whatever, then they book a speech and I send them a set of questions. And then from those answers, I find out a bit about them, you know, who they are, words and phrases, which is really important because these speeches have got to sound, you know, authentic. The phrases that like a hedge fund manager would use in New York are going to be totally different from the plumber in Watford, or that plumber in Watford is going to be totally different to, say, a lorry driver from Barnsley. You know, it's just simple. Sometimes it's just simple word changes. Sometimes it's the phrases, the cultural and social reference points that you're using. You know, it's all needs thinking about when you're writing all these speeches. But the record is a groom who contacted me 3 years before his wedding. That was pretty far out. But, I mean, every week in the summer, pretty much every week in the summer, I'll get someone who contacts me on the day of the wedding. Usually a best man.
Oh my!
Sometimes no. Sometimes a groom. But that happens. And if I can help them out, I'll help them out. But it can get, I mean, generally speaking, most people come to me with about, I would say, 4 to 5 weeks to go. That's probably when they start thinking about it. Because say if you're in the UK, most best men are going to be doing their thing in the spring or the summer. So if you're made best man a year in advance, you get to Christmas, you think, I'll get Christmas and New Year out of the way. And then before you know it, it's the end of January, where if you're making a speech in April, that gives you about 8 weeks to get stuff sorted out. But you don't really see it like that because you think, oh, well, that's April, that's miles away. I've only got to January. And before you know it, it's the end of, or it's the middle of, it's the middle of March, and you've got three, 4 weeks to go, whatever. So that's how most people operate. I would say they, it's about 4, 5, 6 weeks, that kind of timeline. I mean, you know, now I'm speaking to people who are thinking about it for next summer.
Wow.
But you know, they, but because Christmas comes up and New Year, they think, well, I'll tell you what, I'll save my money. I'll buy it in the New Year. We, you know, we have a bounce in January where everyone decides to lose weight, stop drinking, get their speeches worked out. So that's when we have a spike in inquiries in January.
So if someone contacts you on the day of their wedding, or on the day of the wedding, they're a best man, what can you actually do? Have you got these kind of back pocket generic jokes that you know always tend to land? They'll help just get him through the day, get him through the speech. And get a few kind of cheap laughs, because you haven't got any time to really get to know them, have you? If it's
no, I haven't got any time, time to know them. I don't do generic sort of speeches. I've done it for so long, and I've written so many speeches that I will look at someone as answers, and I think, you know, I'll immediately be able to pick out things that are funny about them. If they're a Newcastle United fan, you know that. Whether it's you can factor in something about being permanently miserable, never winning anything, blah blah blah, or you know. If they're like, you know, a teacher, you know, they enjoy 51 weeks holiday a year or whatever it is. I've got good friends with teachers. That's a joke, obviously. But there'll be something about something that you could have some fun with. And I've done it so often now that I can pick out key points in all their answers. And I think, well, I can weave that together in that way, and that way, and that way. I don't have stock jokes that I put in or anything like that. It's just been a case of... of a lot of practice, you know, of working out how to go through people's answers and write the story, because that's what my speeches are. My speeches are stories. When I'm talking about best man speech, I work out how to make the whole thing into a story. That's what I'm looking to do. That's how I plot it out. So what I don't do is I don't have like an intro and then a load of stories and an ending. I mean, sometimes it wouldn't work like that because I get the quality of answers I get varies so much. I mean, it's not infrequent that best man, and I had it the other day, will send me literally for every single answer will send me about 4 words because they can't be bothered. And then you just have to get a bit creative with it. So what I'm saying is if I was just doing like the standard best man format, which is like an intro, a few stories and an ending, it wouldn't work because a lot of people don't have the stories.
I remember you telling me before that sometimes you'll speak to someone who needs a speech written, say a best man again, but they have literally no story sometimes, or they just can't think of anything interesting. Yeah. How do you even go about them writing that?
It's very frequent that people don't have stories. In fact, not having stories is the most common issue that best men have, mainly because either they genuinely don't have any stories, or the stories they have are way too edgy for a wedding. And those are the smart ones, because I mean, I'm sure you've been to loads of weddings. Lots of best men decide, well, they'll chuck those stories in there anyway. But if they're thinking about it in a more sensible way, then I think, well, we can't put those edgy stories in there, and I haven't got anything to put in at all. So what am I going to put in? And that's when I started writing speeches. I've always written them as a story. So you're getting fun and the humour out of plotting the ascent of this man or boy, whatever it was, to where he finds himself lucky enough to marry this lovely lady, and having. I mean, most stories are, I mean, occasionally there are some decent stories, but most of them are fairly, you know, the usual stuff, you know, got hammered, traffic cone on head, you know, lost his car keys, whatever, you know, that's kind of the whole, so that, I mean, most of them aren't good enough anyway. And if you haven't got a killer punchline, the last thing you want to do with a story is take everyone through the nitty gritty in real time to this punchline. The punchline's really flimsy, and then before you know it, no one laughs, and you're looking at the longest sort of 10 minutes of your life. So it's working out how to be more original. And I've got awful stories about best men when it's gone wrong.
Ones that you've written speeches for, or people that you've
people come to me, go, no, I'll be out of business. people come to me, there's all kinds of things. People just getting really hammered, people like knocking wine over people as they stand up. Really insulting people, going through ex-girlfriends in date order and marks out of 10. guessing the weight of the bride in profiteroles. It seems to me that a lot of grown men, not saying grown up men, grown men, have their biggest lapses of judgment for their best man speech. When they can really forget that even though they are making this speech about the groom, the whole day is about the bride, they're only a happy couple, but the bride, and anything you might do that might be slightly edgy or upset her, then just don't have it in, because you know it's not about you, it's not about the best man, it's about them as a couple. And if you, it might make your mate laugh in the pub, but on his wedding day, marrying the woman of his dreams, it's probably not going to make him laugh if it's something to do with something that's best left in the pub. So you just need to think really carefully. Would you say thing is, it's quite possible to make a granny really laugh and someone who's sort of quite hip and urbane and 35 years old really laugh. You just have to think more carefully about how you're going to go about that humor.
Yeah, you said you do a lot in the US as well. When I was a maid of honor over there, I was expected to make a speech. Do you have many women then contacting you, brides or bridesmaids, maid of honor, mother of the brides?
Not so much in the UK, although I have written for lots of women in the UK, but the majority of the women I write for are in the US, and the US has a long part of their wedding sort of tradition has been for women to speak. So the mother of the groom will make a speech. Bridesmaids or maid of honor will always make a speech, and that's only kind of slowly catching on here. It's not a huge thing here, but that will probably change. And not so much brides. Brides don't tend to make a speech either here or in the US. They occasionally do, I've written a best man speech that was delivered by two dogs, but I don't know how that worked. There's all kinds of, everyone's making speeches, but there's no hard and fast rules. But it tends to be more the maid of honor is a firm part of the wedding speech agenda in the US, and the mother of groom is pretty popular. But what they do in the US is they're really good with it. So they will say, right, everyone's got 2 minutes or 3 minutes, and you have a hard stop at the end of that. You can have all these speeches. You can have like six sets of speeches, and nobody is overrunning their or outstaying their welcome. Whereas in Britain, nobody talks to anyone at all about who's saying what, how long they're saying it for. And I heard of a father of the bride recently that made a speech using a PowerPoint for over an hour. Oh. That's the father of the bride speech.
Oh, my God.
I mean, yeah, exactly. And then if you've got, so he talks for an hour, you've got a groom who might speak for half an hour. I heard of a wedding once where there were two best men and each of them spoke for 45 minutes.
It's too much.
It's ridiculous. And it just spoils everyone's fun. They don't enjoy the speeches and they don't enjoy it because they've got about half an hour at the free bar on it. And having a party, and I quite like the way the Americans do their things. Their speeches tend to be slightly different. Their speeches tend to be much more emotional and less humor based. That's not always the case, but by and large, if I was to make a generalization, they're looking for more emotion from a best man speech than
the wedding I went to. The mother of the bride did the speech at the rehearsal dinner. So it wasn't even at the wedding. It was, and I spoke at the wedding, but I remember, I think the groom spoke at the rehearsal dinner. It was all a kind of I remember thinking, should I be speaking today when you're not? And it was a bit of a strange setup.
Yeah, rehearsal dinners are a huge part of not every American wedding, but an awful lot of them. And it was something that was pretty new to me. I didn't really understand it, 10 years ago when I sort of set out doing this. But rehearsal dinners are massive. And in many cases, rehearsal dinners, if you're dealing with sort of affluent people, they tend to be as big an event almost as the wedding day. And you're right, I've written for rehearsal dinners where the father of the bride makes a speech, but he doesn't make one on the day. And I think they sort of divvy up who's going to talk where and when, because the problem they've got is pretty much everyone that goes to the rehearsal dinner is going to the main event. So the father of the bride suddenly needs two speeches. He doesn't need that on his plate. So he thinks, well, I'll do it once. It's something that I thought may sort of creep in, but no, it's I just don't think people have the appetite for
And where you do more females, where you have more females coming to you than in the US,
yeah.
And you said men are very last minute. What's the difference in gender there? Are you seeing more kind of preparation and?
Well, there's an interesting thing. Actually. There's an interesting thing. If we just deal with the last minute things, most of my last minute requests will always be from the US, and they are really comfortable with it. So I'll get a British guy who will say, "Look, Adrian, I'm in a complete meltdown. It's so last minute. I've got 4 weeks to go." And I'm thinking, well, that's absolutely fine. And then a guy in the US did it today. I've had two conversations with a guy in the US today. One's in 2 days' time, one's in 3 days' time, and they couldn't be less bothered. And that is a real American trait. But when it comes to the women, women are, and I found this throughout, they're organized and they're quite fastidious in what they want to how they want to do it. They want to stand up and be quite comfortable, and everything to be, no surprises, and it's all good for the day. I think in all the years I've been doing this, I've never had a single last minute request from a woman. No. It just gets just wouldn't happen. It wouldn't.
Do you turn anyone away? I know, obviously, yeah. if you've got too much on, you'd turn them away. But do you ever just think, like, I'm not going to be able to help you?
Yes, it has happened. Not very often, but it has happened. There was one guy, and it's very, very rare, but he was a father of the bride. And he wanted, and the way it works is I do all the questions over email, and an online question form. And he wanted that to be a 3-hour telephone conversation. He said, "No, I want you and me and my wife to get on the phone and we'll speak several hours talking to each other. And then once you've written the speech, I want another several hours conversation going through the speech." And it's just not the way I work. It's not the way I've ever worked. And I just said, "I'm really sorry, but that's not how I work. I don't think I can work for you." And then I said, "I'm really sorry. Bye," in a very polite way. And then he called me back and said, "No, I really, really want you to write my speech." And I said, "I'm really, really sorry, but that is just not going to happen." Because yeah. I could tell right from it's really interesting when you speak to people. Some of the people, you kind of get a feeling for how it's going to work. Sometimes it's not always right. Sometimes you might speak to a client, you think, "Oh my god, they're going to be hard work," and they actually turn out to be lovely. And sometimes you think that people are lovely, and they end up sort of being quite challenging. You can't always get it right, but I've got a fairly good feeling if someone's going to be hard work. And it's only happened once or twice. Occasionally people aren't that sort of into the speech I've written, but that's very rare. And if I can't work it out, then we come to an agreement. But that's maybe once, twice a year, something like that.
I've just thought of a really good question. Have you ever written for a speech for someone for a wedding and then they've divorced, you've written for them again?
Do you know what? Yes, I have.
No way.
I've done all kinds of things. I've written for people all at the same wedding who don't know that I've written their speeches. All of them have written their speeches.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I've one of the first ever grooms I wrote for about 9 years ago. And I remember I remember him because he was one of the first ones, and you tend to remember the first ones. And he got back in contact with me this year saying, disaster, Adrian, disaster marriage and wedding. would you be up for writing me a groom speech again? And he's getting married again. So, I do know, sadly, that some of the people I've written groom speeches for, even though, you know, I've been doing it around about 9-10 years, I've written speeches for people who've got divorced, they've come back and got, you know, best man speech, but he's so it's sometimes it doesn't always work out, obviously, but I have I'm trying to think. You build up kind of relationships with people. You know, one of the very first people I ever wrote a speech for was a really lovely guy, and at the time I was just curious as to who these type of people are that in their lives that want to employ a speechwriter. I happen to be up in London. He sounded like a really nice bloke on the phone, so I said, "Do you want to meet up for a cup of tea and we'll have a chat about your speech?" Which, I mean, I just wouldn't have the time to do now, but at the beginning I did, and got like a house on fire with him. And he was a really nice guy, and I wrote him that best man speech. I wrote another speech for him. I wrote a eulogy for his mum's funeral, and then I wrote a speech for his daughter's 21st as well. And we chat now like friends on the phone and over email. So it's quite.
It's a personal process, isn't it? You're getting to know quite a lot of detail, like their innermost thoughts and feelings and stories, and you probably are a bit of a counsellor because they end up probably speaking to you more than they've spoken to anyone for a long time.
I know loads of things about lots of people that is it exceptionally private, exceptionally like personal, sometimes that their own partners don't know. But people will come back to me and book several speeches. I mean, I've written quite a few eulogies. I don't advertise eulogies, but I end up writing eulogies for people that I've written speeches for. And you kind of and that kind of cements a relationship because that's obviously a pretty sad time, and they trust you enough to take care of it. So that's that's quite a nice, a nice position to be in. But some people have come back. I think record is. I think I've written some. Got people about maybe 5-6 different speeches or something. Mostly people will buy one or two speeches in their lifespan. That makes it sound like they're going to die. No, I mean in their period where you're sort of in that way.
Yeah.
Period. I mean, but you know, I've started branching out. I mean, I've started doing communications work from the back of my speech writing as well, which is
really
yeah. Which is kind of crazy.
How long does it take you to write a speech?
It all depends. I'll put it this way. When I first wrote my very first speech, which I can remember everything about it, and I couldn't tell you a single thing about a speech I wrote yesterday, but I can remember everything about it, it took me 4 days to write the best man speech. And I agonized over everything. And it was just getting to work out, you know, how I was going to put it together and... all I can say is it takes a lot less than four days now. So,
yeah.
But you think it's a bit like when it gets busy, I haven't just got speeches to write. So in the summer, I'll have speeches to write. I'll have amendments to make. I'll have sales calls to make. And then that's not considering anything to do with the website, you know, the analytics, the social media, all that sort of things that I check on a daily basis. So that whole digital side of things, I really enjoy it. I can't believe that I would ever fall into that, but I absolutely really enjoy that. But that's something that I invest a lot of time in. So when I'm not writing speeches, I'm using all the different sites. I'm using all the Vimeo, AccuRanker, and analytics, and all these different types of things that basically help my business along.
You're a marketer.
It's fascinating to all that, you know, I found all this software that helps me do this X, Y, and Z in a more efficient way, and automate bits and pieces. And, that's another big part of it. And I don't farm anything out, which is a weakness as well as kind of like a strength. The strength is that I have control over absolutely everything. I'm not a control freak. It's just that, I've seen how people do stuff and I think, well, I could do that and also do the speeches, and I'm not wasting a load of money, and I can do it quite quickly. So like the social media, I had a firm doing a social media, and that was costing me quite a dollop of cash every month, and I just worked out how they were doing it, and then I just did it for, you know, for myself, which, you know.
You are the brand in a way, so you're always going to be the best salesperson, aren't you? You're always going to be the best marketer because it is you. You're selling,
yeah.
Essentially. You're selling. Yes. So do you have someone else in your team as well, or is it just you?
I can exclusively reveal my team is two people. The other person is Amy, who is my wife. She hates working with me. So it's just us two. So she does all the invoicing and all the emailing and spreadsheets and stuff like that. And I do all the speeches. So it's just me. And I had an email recently, actually, from a very well-known tabloid journalist that wanted to know if he wanted to come and write speeches for me.
Really? Well, yeah, probably more money in your game now than there is there.
Well, I mean, it's interesting the way things move around. But so I'll get people saying, can I write speeches for you? And blah, blah, blah. I mean, occasionally I'll get people, and I can't believe people send emails like this, but they say, I'm thinking of setting up my own wedding speech writing business in the UK. Can you give me hints or tips?
Yeah, can you give me tips?
or can we organise a Zoom call? Which I find amazing. I mean, I'm half tempted to speak to them sometimes, but no, I don't wish them ill, but I mean, you know, there's certain ways of going about things, but no, it's just me. And the reason why it's just me, because I can get all that digital stuff done, but the reason why it is me just for the speeches is the quality control. So I can make sure every time that what I write, what I put out is absolutely great. I have read other speeches that have been written professionally, and wow, that's all I'm going to say. I need to make sure that my mine are great, and then the business will take care of itself, hopefully.
And then you write it, then you send it to them. They then give you feedback, do they? Or say, oh, I'm not sure about this, or and how? What's that process? Do you? Is it just no? Sorry, that's what I've written. There you go. Or do you then kind of take their feedback on board? Do you do a little round of edits? Or
no, there's unlimited editing, which some people take to the extreme.
Yeah.
So an awful lot of people are really happy with the first draft. I will never hear from them again. The job done, gone. You know, and what I've learned is that blokes are really busy. Even if they're really super happy with everything, you're getting a nice email from them, everything is just not going to happen. That's it. They're gone. It's business like done. So that'll be about 40%. The other 40% will be absolutely love it, but can we change X, Y, and Z? Which I'm more than happy to do. That's absolutely fine. And then you'll get, say, maybe 20% that will want maybe more extensive changes, or will come back and say, oh, I forgot to tell you, he was in the French Foreign Legion for 10 years. And so then you've suddenly got to change the whole speech. Whatever. So, but that's fine. You know, I always say I'll edit as much as you wish. And generally speaking, because I'm, without sounding like an idiot, I'm pretty good at what I do. So I can make those changes fairly quickly. And chances are I've got it near enough on the first draft. So it only takes a little bit of knocking around in order to get it to where it needs to be. So it's fairly painless. And obviously some people will add their own little touches to it, which used to really wind me up. But because I was thinking, well, what's wrong with it? I'm quite comfortable with it. I mean, sometimes people do a really good job. They'll add things in there and I think, oh well, you know, that's fine, that's great. And then I'll just tidy it up a little bit. And sometimes I'm thinking, why on earth did you put that in there? But I used to say that, but now I'm way too professional. I say that's great. Well done.
And what about the delivery? Do people, I mean, it's not up to you to deliver it. You're writing it, but do they want to kind of practice it with you? Do they want you to be involved in how?
I have done some coaching sessions with people. I don't really offer it, but people, if we get on, and I get on with most people, but if we get on and they think about they'd like some coaching, then I have done some coaching sessions in the past. But usually they spend time with the speech and they'll see that a speech is, which has been written as a speech, is very different to what they would have come up with themselves. Then the delivery kind of takes care of itself because the pauses are in there. It's all written in quite short, easily digestible, deliverable sentences and paragraphs, and there's a pathway through the speech. So I always say to them, spend some time with the speech, and if you think that you might need some help with it afterwards, then we can always sort of talk about it. And most of the time, they're just happy they're just happy, you know, doing it themselves. When I go and meet people for the coaching sessions, we just end up talking about their lives quite a lot. Yeah. Not too much coaching, which is great for me. But yeah, it's. I mean, the delivery is important, and all. And what I would say is, just do it as slowly as you can. Take as much time as you can over it. No one delivered a really great speech in like speaking a million miles an hour. Always use a microphone. Forget props. Forget, you know, all these things that holding up things that people can see, like baby grow from when he was one or whatever, or whatever it is. You know, it just adds to the complication. People need to move around. They can't see. People start talking amongst themselves. They take their attention away from you. Forget it. What you want is route one. The simplest way to a great best man speech is just to have a really, really funny, well-written, efficient speech. And everything else is just a diversion, really.
With your job, it's weird, isn't it? Because the professional satisfaction element that people would think of actually seeing the person deliver a good speech is you don't really get that, because I take it you're not at the weddings that you're writing the speeches for. So you're not seeing them actually deliver it in the end. So you're just kind of sending them off with it, hoping then it goes well.
Yeah, my professional satisfaction is I get lots of lovely emails, but people saying, you know, that's amazing, I love it, and that was it's life changing. You know, there were some really gushing emails, lovely. Most of those people then get so caught up in the life they forget to leave me a review. But the reviews were a really important part, and I love those reviews, because they are the people that are motivated enough, who actually loved it, but were motivated enough to leave a review. And all my reviews are genuine. In fact, it actually looks a little bit weird, because I've got more reviews than any other speechwriter by quite a way than anyone in the world, which sounds quite flash, doesn't it? But I mean, like, there aren't many of us, but and they are lovely. And that was really important to building the business were the reviews. Because it doesn't take much working out that people need a trust. They really need a trust, especially, I mean, back in the day when I didn't have any reviews and the website was a bit shonky and everything else, trying to sell a speech into America was hard work. You had to be quite lucky in a lot of respects. And also you're keeping an eye on the language you use on the website. You know, if I'm using the word bloke or whatever, on the website, then, you know, American people think, oh, hang on, he's all the way over there. It's not really going to work. So, now I've got that. You know, I just spoke to a guy in Chicago about an hour ago. He said, no, I read all the reviews, and some of them do. I've got 345 reviews. Some people do read all 345.
Wow. No. Yeah. God, that's amazing. Actually, that is a huge number of reviews.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote, and the thing is, I've sent so many more emails out to people saying, I'm glad you loved it. Can you leave me a review? But the tricky thing is, nobody wants anyone to know they've used me, or very, very few people.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, occasionally I'll get women who will call up, and this happens, you know, every now and again. They'll say, look, my husband's boyfriend or future husband really needs a speech. Can you sort of help them out? So they do it with their knowledge, and it's sort of like shared. But most of the time, people want to keep it. And I've had some emails where people, I had an email from a guy, he was absolutely over the moon with his speech. And I said, do you fancy leaving an anonymous review? And this is on the telephone. He called me up to say how over the moon he was. And he just said, no, I'd rather not. Can we leave it there? I think it's just they don't want the trail back to them. In fact, I've had a few very sort of short, succinct emails saying, please don't ever contact me again.
They're dining out on the, you know, the compliments still.
I've had a few well-known comedians who've apparently been really laughing at my speeches. In fact, one guy in the US got a radio show out of it. Apparently,
no, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, he did say that. He said I needed to be. He was one of the exceptions for the funny in Americans. He said I want a really, really funny speech. X, Y, and Z are going to be there, and I really need to get this next stage in my radio career. I need a radio show out of it, and it worked. Well, yeah,
because I mean, writing comedy isn't easy, and like you said, you're thinking about the audience here. It's not a stand-up show where everyone there has come to listen to you tell jokes. You know, you're trying to appease, you know, an 89-year-old grandmother or whatever to father of the bride to cousins to, and of course you've got to tie in all the family politics as well, because I guess that you must get that all the time. Oh, actually, we can't say that, or we've got to mention this, or
I mean, but that tends to be more. Yeah, I mean, definitely. With the best man, they will often have a chat with the bride, and the bride will say, "Look, I don't. Can you forget this? Forget that? Or my family," which is absolutely fair enough. It's fine. I mean, sometimes the brides demand to read the speech in advance, which I think is getting a little bit beyond it. But
blimey, really?
Yeah. Family politics actually tends to play more into a groom speech and a father of the bride speech. I mean, it's not unusual for me to. In fact, one of my most read blog posts, I should have spent more time on it, is father of the bride issues with the son-in-law. There's a lot of a lot of that goes on, and grooms who have either challenging relationships with their own parents or with their future in-laws, whatever. So you just skirt around that, just, you know.
Yeah. And have you written for anyone famous? You might not be able to say the name, but you can.
Yeah, no, I've written for loads of famous people. Actually, I can't say any of their names. Yeah, but I wrote for an England footballer who was actually just about to go onto the pitch for an international when he revealed his true identity. I've written for all kinds of people. I was writing for two way back in the day, and this guy was a jungle DJ, and he went to Leeds University. I said, "That's amazing." And I was more obsessed with the fact, I think that I went to Leeds. I weirdly, that's another aside, I write for a disproportionate amount of people who went to Leeds University.
Really?
It is so weird. Every week, Leeds University, it's always been there. Anyway, and I was more obsessed with the fact that he went to Leeds and lived near where I did, but I didn't realise he just had two back-to-back number ones with his...
Wow.
I've written for lots of famous people. I've signed a few NDAs and stuff like that. But it's just, I mean...
You're a writer, but you have to be good with people. You have to be able to relate to them, don't you, and get these stories out of them, which is skillful in a way to make them feel comfortable.
Yeah, I think it's when you build up the trust on the telephone call. So you have to have speak to them in order to do the business. And I do write across the board. I mean, I've written for supremely wealthy individuals. I mean, you know, people that have started their own banks, people are hedge fund managers in New York. And then I wrote for a guy who works in a cardboard box factory in Northampton. And I said, "What do you do in the cardboard box factory?" And he said, "I assemble the cardboard boxes." he was a lovely, straightforward bloke. He just said, "I want a really great speech." Yeah. No one's expecting it from me. And he's got to believe you as well, because he's got to think, well, hang on, there's Adrian there with his shiny website and everything. How is he going to know how to talk like me or whatever and be able to sort of have a speech that relates to who I am? And it just, you know, you just get their trust and get their answers and away you go.
So let's get back to how you got into this then, because I remember you, when I spoke to you a few years ago, you told me that you, correct me if I've got this wrong, if I've remembered it right, but you wanted to be a TV presenter, didn't you? And you thought that was going to be really creative.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying that you thought, you know, I could get on there, I can write really cool stuff. But actually in reality, it was very, very much reading an auto cue and not creative in the slightest and pretty boring.
I was a TV presenter for, in the end, about 14 years. And it was the least creative, well, the shows that I did, maybe, but the least thought-provoking or anything. There was no intelligence behind it. I mean, it was a real letdown in that respect. I mean, I started off as a Top Gear presenter, and I was a Top Gear presenter for a year. And I thought, given who had gone before me, that it was going to be an opportunity to have some real fun and be quite, not maverick, but out there. And you could have some, it could be quite edgy, it could be quite entertaining. It wasn't. It was presenting by numbers. It was so boring. It was so boring. I'm quite happy to say that now. But that was only outdone by, I then went to Fifth Gear on Channel 5, which was that, but, you know, but more so. And then the thing is that because I was coming, I used to be a test driver for a car magazine. So I was coming at it from a writer. So on those shows, I was writing my own scripts. They would come back having gone through six sets of people, being completely mullered. Nobody's bright enough or or brave enough to go with what I'd written, and then it all gets watered down, and then suddenly, you know, 20 years later, I'm writing speeches that everyone really loves and they're all laughing about, and I just think, well, you know, I wish it had been like that. And then you go into other shows. So I did a lot of other shows for Discovery, for ITV, for Channel 4, where the scripts are written for you, and by that point, you're just taking the money. You've got no creative input. Not things wouldn't have upset anyone, but saying anything slightly edgy or that it just all gets watered down, because what you're dealing with is an industry which is run entirely by people who are freelancers and they're just paranoid about their own job security. So they don't want the buck to stop with them, whether you're a serious producer or quite frequently you're involved in a channel. They're only on they were only on 2-year rolling contracts. So,
right. Yeah.
It's not an industry I'd be keen. Oh no, I would never go back. Well, not they would have me back, but I wouldn't do that. I mean, if I made millions, maybe. But what happened was some friends of mine from we all went to university together. They were all in different industries, but one guy wrote a website for a lads website back in the day, about 20 odd years ago, that ended up becoming the largest provider of stag and hen do's in Europe. So it ended up being massive. A mate of mine who was in publishing went to work with them. Another guy went to work with them. We're all university mates. We used to hang around at university. They all left their jobs and all went to work for this company called Chili Sauce. It was huge. It had massive offices in London Bridge. It had like 100 and something staff. It still is mega. And they bought another website to do with weddings. It had wedding speech writers on it, and they knew that I was looking to get out of TV and everything else, and they said, we'll put you on as a wedding speech writer. And I just thought, oh god, this is just going to be rubbish, this is not going to work. So they did, and then a bit of this, an email every now and again, nothing really happening, and then one week in April, I remember it was, I got 6 inquiries. So I said to my wife, I said, well, I'm going to set up my own website and then advertise as a wedding speech writer and see what happens. Mm. And I was only just learning about websites then. I put together a really, really, it was dodgy website. It didn't look great. I mean, I advertised it, and then pretty much from that moment, it just started to grow. And the more you do it, the better you get at it, the more you understand what people want. It was just a continual learning. I was learning stuff. I learned stuff every week doing about how to do it, what people are looking for. So you get to a point where, and it took years. It took about 8 years to get to where we needed to be on so many ways, the way the business operated, the way the website looked, how people were finding us, all kinds of different moving parts to it. And then you're employing freelancers to help you with SEO or whatever it is, and you find that doesn't work. So that sets that back. And it was a total sort of up and down journey. But right from those first weeks, I just thought, actually, I think this might be my business. And within about 6 months, it was definitely my business. You know, I wasn't looking at anything else. It's brilliant. I mean, I still love it. Everyone gets fed up with their job every now and again, but I do still love it.
That's great. Well, the nice thing is you get to just meet different people every day, don't you, from all walks of life.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, there was a name came in on an email, and I thought, blimey, the only person I know with that name is a really famous British and Irish Lions forward. I wonder if it's him. And I called him up, and it was him. So we like ended up talking about rugby, which was great. And you just get talking to people who you've never met before, obviously, and are really funny and really make you laugh. And it's lovely to have that, because I work from, you know, for the last 9 years, whatever it is, I've worked from my home on my own. And I'm very much a people person. I like being with people. I like to try and make them laugh and spending time with people. So being on my own on a desk and stuff has never been what I've been about. I really rely on talking to these people, and especially in sort of like lockdown, if people call me up and we've got something in common, then I'll end up bending their ear for like 20 minutes because I just need. I just need to speak to people. I did think about the ultimate conclusion. I thought, why don't I write a stand-up comedy routine? And then I just thought, oh, I just can't be bothered.
I was going to ask you about that, because you kind of come back to comedy a little bit, don't you? And you obviously can write comedically really well. And is that something that you kind of wish you'd done? Is that a kind
definitely.
Of...
Because I think...
Yeah, journey.
I think about things in comedy terms every single second of the day. When I'm in the car... when I'm eating my food, when I'm talking to you, everything I do, I think about how can I make that funny.
It's interesting.
And I've been like that ever since I can remember. And I've got a twin brother who's completely opposite. And that's something, and because I've spent years thinking about it and writing about it, and I can instantly think, I mean, it drives my wife absolutely mad and my children, because I'm always thinking, I just say to them, like a scene from The Office, like they get this amazing level of professional comedy performance free every single day. They're lucky they are. And obviously they're not that thrilled about it. But I do wish that. And if I could be slightly, I did try and enter some comedy competitions. And I just thought, am I too old? All these people, like all these funky, like young people. But then I look at it all the time. I look at what people are doing professionally with comedy writing and what works and what doesn't work. And sometimes you look at it and you think, my, that is bad. I mean, that is poor, really poor. Especially if you've got some of the comedy script writers on some of these chat shows that write the links and everything for the very well-known comedians and stuff. I mean, you know, I've seen Alan Carr, who I absolutely love, deliver some really shonky lines because he's just going in and delivering.
Yeah.
I've seen all of them do it, Graham Norton as well. But they are funny people. They just get stuff written for them that sometimes isn't that great.
But would you want to be a comedy writer, or would you also want to be a performer and perform your own work?
I can't deny that. I actually love the performance of it, because I love being in the moment and everyone's laughing because of something you said. I absolutely love that. Whether I'd be brave enough to do that. I did that. I entered myself in to say you think you're funny, which was... It was the sort of comedy thingy. But due to, oh my God, that odious phrase, due to COVID, it got put online, and I just don't see how you can do it online. So that didn't kind of go through. Mm. It's so multifaceted, comedy, about the different types of reactive comedy, situation comedy, you know, pub comedy. You know, there's so many different types that, you know, I think. Matt Lucas, for instance, I remember going to see him in stand-up when he was 18. I'm sorry, Banana Cabaret in Balham, where just before he went to Bristol University, or Bristol Old Vic, what it was, to do his degree course. And I've never seen he was so funny, absolutely hilarious. And I rated him.
He just had it.
When I see him on a Bake Off, I just think it doesn't work. It's not your comedy. It doesn't work.
No.
And I think that for
I agree. You didn't want to go into sort of script or comedy writing, then you sort of decided, I want to go into the presenting side. But not comedy, was it?
No, because I was delusional. I'd ended up becoming a motoring journalist. So I used to test drive cars and stuff, which I can, you know, it wasn't really my thing. I kind of ended up in it a little bit by accident, and people were doing it. I knew I ended up doing it. It wasn't my kind of thing. And from there, I'd had this very young delusional mindset, which was, well, if I'm doing this, what I should really end up being is a Top Gear presenter. So that evening when I had the thought, or that week when I had the thought, I was with my mate in our house in Balham. I watched Top Gear, and at the very end of it, I looked at who the name of the series producer was, and then I called him up the next day. I got into directory inquiries. I mean, when was the last time I used that? I called him up and I said, I'm a test driver for a car magazine. I really want to present your show. And he said, well, come up and see us. It didn't work out that time, but then they got back in contact with me a few months later and said, come for a screen test. And then as I was going into the screen test, a certain Richard Hammond was coming out of the screen test, and I got that gig. And so I presented the last year of the old format of Top Gear. And then he obviously went on the new one and became a multi.
Yeah, became mega famous. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So that,
I was gonna say, I digress then, because I was gonna say, you did mention COVID for your business, which is Wedding Central. You know, weddings were off. Everybody in the wedding industry was suffering. Yeah. I take it then, did you pivot and start writing other speeches, or was it just, you know, game over?
It was game over for 13 months. We didn't. As soon as we made the announcement, I remember driving up north that day, on the day you made the announcement, and I sold a speech to a guy in the morning, and I thought, you're nuts. There's no way that this wedding's going to happen. But I, you know, we'll go through with it. If you want to do it, you can hang on to it, whatever. And Boris made the announcement, everyone stay at home, you know, don't go to the pub, blah, blah, blah. And it was like pressing a button. It just, everything just stopped. And I looked at the analytics and it just went bang down like that. And it was just flatlined. Yeah. Or we didn't, you know, we didn't turn a wheel for pretty much 13 months and everything was shut down. So we, there was nothing we could do. I mean, the good thing about our situation is we had no premises. We had no staff. We got no stock. It was simply, yeah, all I, yeah, did was I went to the computer, I turned off the ads. And then we, you know, it was quite difficult, I think, for my wife to get her head around. I was always quite a bit more circumspect about it. I just thought, well, if we can just ride it out, and just cut our expenses right down, we'll be all right. But at the time I was thinking, you know, obviously it'd be a nightmare if this lasts until July. I had no idea that it was going to be another year before things started to move again. So yeah, it wasn't great, but you know, good things came out of it. Like, you know, I ended up getting some other connections. I mean, I did send out an email, a mass mail, you know, MailChimp, I can say that, email to like 12,000 people, and I got saying, basically, if you've got anything that needs writing, can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry, it made a picture noise, like I'd taken a picture, but I haven't. Sorry, carry on.
I sent a mass email to about 12,000 people, and I got two writing bits out of it. I got a few emails saying from blokes I've been from before saying, you know, good luck, Adrian. I hope it all works out and everything else. But there was one guy who came back to me. He was the father of the bride, and he said, the father of the bride speech was amazing. Can you write my dating profile? I haven't heard from him. That must be well over a year ago, and I haven't heard from him. So either it was a huge success or it was a huge failure.
Or did you write it?
Sorry?
Did you write it?
I've written loads of things. I can't even begin to tell you the amount of different things, not in lockdown, but in the last 9 years that I've written that have been not to do with weddings, that people say to me, actually, can you do this? I was thinking, well, I don't know.
Oh my God.
I didn't get anything out of that, but it gave us a couple of things. It allowed us to turn the ads off and find out that actually when the business did start coming back, we didn't need the ads anymore, which was huge for us. I mean, that was huge. And it also put me in connection with a couple of different people who I started doing some different types of work for actually after COVID. So I started doing more like sort of comms kind of stuff. And that looks like being a bigger part of what I'm going to be doing in the future. So, whilst I wouldn't like to repeat the exercise, I did manage to build a treehouse out of the trees in my garden. So that was like a huge plus point.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, very nice. Different part of the brain.
But it's all good. I mean, well, touch wood, it's all going to be.
Yeah, it's picked up there. Are you back to kind of pre-COVID levels? Or? I suppose it's winter. I mean, people have weddings in winter, but I guess your busy seasons are, as you said, spring, summer.
Yeah, I mean, in the winter, I write for Aussies because we go into their summer, so it's their wedding season.
Of course, yeah.
I write for a lot of lovely, normally lovely Jewish guys on the East Coast because, you know, fits in with their holidays and stuff like that. Winter weddings are more popular, but obviously they're nowhere near as popular as summer weddings. So there's always a stream of business sort of coming through. But it's quite nice to have a bit more time in November and December because, you know, when it gets busy, it's properly silly. You know, people want wedding speeches, they want them tomorrow, and it's all around the world. So, you know, if you type in best man speech, I'm on the front page. First page for Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America,
that's
wherever.
Brilliant.
So, and it's all sort of coming at you. So, it's quite nice to have some time where you think, oh, go for a bike ride. I sound like a toddler or something, but no, yeah, you know what I mean.
Oh, I'm glad it's doing well. So how can people find out them more if they want to book a speech from you? What do they do? Go to your website.
We are called allspeechesgreatandsmall.com. And if you type in best man speech, groom speech, father of the bride speech, we're all on page one for all those kind of things. Best man speech writer, whatever it is. And then just click. There's a little click thing that says, have a call with Adrian. And then you click and you have a call with me. So, yeah, that's how it works. Very simple and straightforward.
Amazing. And do you charge by the kind of just a one-off process, or is it kind of time length?
It's a one-off process. It's a one-off process. So I have the same fee for all the speeches that write wherever you are in the world, which kind of works. If you're British, it's great. If you're British, it's got even better after Brexit and COVID if you're in America because of the exchange rate. But it's still quite... But yeah. I do feel sorry for people living in New Zealand, not for the sake of living in New Zealand. Obviously, it's an amazing place. But the exchange rate is quite punchy for them, and in South Africa as well. I have that one. I mean, people come to me sometimes and say, I've got a half-finished speech. We finish it off. I'm just not interested in doing that. Or I want a really short speech. I just don't get involved because I can't be bothered to work it out. And normally, you know, if I have to write a really short speech, and some of the best man speeches I write for in the US will be only 3 minutes long sometimes, it takes... They have really short speeches in the US. It takes me just as long to work it out to fit everything into 3 minutes as it does if I'm waffling on for 6.5-7 minutes. So it's one flat fee for everyone.
You'll be writing for TikTok soon. You know, people calling you up saying, "Can you write my sketch?"
Do you know what? I kind of don't function on social media at all. I don't have it on my phone or anything like that. And I downloaded TikTok. I had it on my phone for about 4 minutes before I just thought, this is rubbish. I've got to get... And I got rid of it. So if I've offended anyone, I'm really sorry. But I do kind of struggle with that. But I mean, I'm slightly older.
Yeah.
And I was never introduced to it. I mean, I was out of the country when Facebook was launched. I wasn't here for that. And it all kind of left me behind. And I that's probably something I should have caught up with a bit more. I mean, I do post on social media all the time, but it's just videos
I've come up with
bits and pieces. There's nothing meaningful. Not that I'm not capable of it, but I'm just, it's not something I've just...
Yeah, I think you're quite lucky, actually. It's quite nice if it passed you by.
Yeah, well, I can't get any business out of it because no one will share it, or no one will retweet it or like it or anything else, because they don't want anyone to know they're looking at a speech writing company.
Of course. Yeah, they don't want you to promote it. I was going to ask, do they send you videos?
I've had about 3 videos. Probably not, then. In all the years that I've been doing it, of people who actually sent me the videos of them performing the speech. Which is quite nice to see them. It's not something that many people do. I mean, it stays personal with them. So by the time they've said thanks for the speech, then it's their speech, and that's something I'm very keen to underline. You know, that every now and again, not so much now, but back in the day, people used to say, "I think this feels like cheating," whatever. And I'm just thinking, well, look. You take your hair into the hairdresser's, whatever it is, and he cuts it, and you walk out with your hair. It's still your hair, even though you did it. I mean, you can cut your own hair. I mean, I know people who live on submarines cut their own hair, but it's very much, I'll take all your words and ideas and thoughts, everything else, and put them in the best possible format, and then it's yours. You know? So, yeah. I like them to sort of keep that ownership.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me today all about it. I remember, just loving learning about it a few years ago when I met you on a project. And I'm glad to hear it's still going, for sure, and it's doing well.
Yeah, it's all good.
I mean, I kind of want to know who the famous people are, but I know you can't tell.
Do you know what? There's been so many of them, I can't remember all of them. In fact, I was there the other day thinking, oh, yeah, I wrote for him. Who was that? I forgot about that. It's interesting though, because back, you know, when I was younger and stuff, in the early 30s, if you were out and people were like, oh, there's, you know, you said you're a Top Gear presenter, people were like, oh, wow, that's cool kind of thing. It's nothing compared to the reaction I get when I tell people that I'm a wedding speech writer. It's like that, but times 1 million.
Yeah.
They're like, what?
Yeah. It's a bit like my dad was for 25 years head of obituary writing at the BBC, which is quite similar in a way, because it's I remember, because it reminds me so much, because he'd, you know, it would all be about people's lives. It wasn't morbid.
Yeah.
It's really nice kind of life writing, and he'd always find ways of putting in, you know, bits of humor. And then he'd be asked as well to write, you know, eulogies, or can you help me write this? And it's similar.
No, it's good. It's good. I feel very lucky to have landed on my feet doing it. It was difficult because I said goodbye to TV, and then the show that I started out on, that was, you know, regular car show, became the most successful global phenomenon of a TV show with a millionaire presenter. So I'm not going to lie, at times that was quite a strain on my emotions. There you go. I've admitted it.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
watching me. Yeah, no worries. Cheers.
That was Adrian Simpson, whose company is called All Speeches Great and Small. If you Google it, you'll find it, and I'll put the address in the show notes too. He's also on all social media platforms. Now, next week, episode 2 of series 3 is hugely different but equally fascinating. I had the pleasure of speaking to Jenny McKay, a reverend and a vet. Jenny is both a veterinarian pathologist and in 2019 became a Church of England minister. So two very different and fascinating vocations, certainly not two you usually hear together, not as far as I know anyway. And she is what is termed a minister in secular employment. So she has her role as a Church of England minister, but she also continues her career as a pathologist. And we discuss what she believes are the huge benefits of this, as well as her general role in both positions and how she engages with all the different people that she works with. So tune in. It's really interesting. I learned a lot, which is the best part of this podcast, really. And yeah, please do feel free to get in contact on social media and let me know what episodes you like. See you then.